So like I was saying, what was it have on the screen? John Campos, that's my name. It's nice to meet everybody here. We're thankful that Guillermo gave us the invitation to come and be with y'all this morning. So, you know, thanks for the invitation. So for a little bit about me, because I think most of you don't know me or anything about me. My name is John Campos. And my parents are Jose and Kathy Campos. They worship at Hickory Knoll with the Hispanic congregation down there. My parents started that congregation back in 2002. And this, my wife, Sabrina, we're expecting our first in February. So if you need something, you know, if your prayer list is running short, just can't find enough things to pray about, you can pray for the guest speaker and his wife who are expecting their first baby in February. That's always good, right? This is why we're here this morning. Right, because Jesus rose from the dead. So I'm excited to share with you all this morning. So this is my family. I grew up in New Orleans mostly. From ages 8 to 18, I was in New Orleans. That's the city I consider my home city. If people ask me where I'm from, most of the time, that's what I'll say is New Orleans. Because that's where I was formed, right? So before that, I was in Argentina. But New Orleans is where I became a person, you know, at least in my mind. I grew up at Hickory Knoll Church of Christ. They told me, you know, great church, I love it there. They told me all the time that we need to be more like Jesus, right? That's our goal, is to become more and more like Jesus. We need to be like Jesus. My wife said that I took it a little bit too literally. But, you know, I think that's all right. I actually interned at a Christ Community Health Center, as it's called. It's like a health clinic for the underprivileged in Memphis. That's where we live, in Memphis. I'm studying there. And the first day I was there, I met one of the nutritionists. And upon finding out that my name is John, he said, well, I feel like it's my professional obligation to inform you that a diet of locusts and honey is not sustainable. So I thanked him for that. So I grew up in New Orleans, but then moved to Argentina. I lived in Argentina for a few years as a kid, and then I went back as an adult because I wanted to work with a church down there. That's where I met my wife in South America. She's from Brazil, and we met in Bolivia, and then got married in Argentina because we just like to complicate things. But this was our wedding. It was very nice. And that's her parents and her brother next to her, and those are my parents and my brother on my side. And the church actually here in Mandeville helped us out tremendously. So I'm not sure who here, what everybody knows, but the Spanish church here, they supported us. They used their offering and sent it to us, and we really needed it. And so we're really thankful for that, and we're thankful for the partnership that we had. They supported us in our work down in Argentina. And it became especially important because at some point, my mother-in-law, Sabrina's mom, had a heart attack and a stroke. And so she was in a coma for a while. So when that happened right away, we went to Brazil. And it turns out that we really needed to move to Brazil so that we could... I don't know what time I started, but I'll just keep going until I finish. Is that all right? We ended up needing to move to Brazil so that we could help out with the family. There was a lot of things that needed to be taken care of. She was unresponsive for a while. She was in a coma for a couple months, hospitalized for a little bit more. So that was a very difficult time for us. And there were, you know, a little ray of light, a little ray of sunshine, in what was really complete darkness. So we are very thankful. They had increased the amount of support that they were going to give us. And during those months, obviously, we did not work with the church. We were busy basically taking care of her mom full time. And they stayed committed to us. And we're really thankful for that because I have a lot of missionary friends. My parents are missionaries. I have a lot of ministry friends. And we hear lots of stories when, you know, things get tough. The church isn't there to be able to take care of them, to see them through to the end. And they did. Y'all did. So I'm really appreciative for that. But that was a difficult moment for us. Because her mom, you know, after the heart attack and the stroke, her heart wasn't beating for about 30 minutes, if I remember correctly. And basically, when she woke up from the coma, she was completely different. She had a lot of brain damage. So she didn't remember who people were. She doesn't remember who my wife is. It was very difficult at that time. It was kind of like losing somebody. Because they woke up and the person that she knew wasn't there anymore. And there's In situations like that, when you're enveloped by darkness, a lot of questions rise to the front, right? Why? Why us? Why her? Why our family? Her family is known all throughout the city and by the Christians there because it's one of the pillars of the community. Why them? That's not fair. Why us? Why now? How could this happen? And I can't talk about this too much without tearing up, so I'm going to talk about another family. there's a lady at our church in Memphis. She's from Guatemala. Sometimes when I think about people that are going through tough times and what that means, I think about, we're going to call her Elisa, just to maintain a little bit of her identity. Her name is Elisa for our purposes. She came from Guatemala, came to the United States. She moved to Memphis, started building her life there along with her husband, very little kids. And at some point, she was fortunate enough to be able to buy a house. She saved up her money. It was not a great house, you know, but it was a house. It was a place that they could work on and make their home. So then she spent years and lots of money, her and her husband, just making this decrepit house into a home for her family. And she was able to do that. Plenty of years, plenty of money, it's plenty of time, and she was able to make this happen. And it's difficult for her because not only is she, you know, from Guatemala, doesn't have a lot of education coming into the States, but also Spanish isn't even her first language. She's actually from the mountains in Guatemala. She speaks a regional dialect. Spanish is her second language. English is her third. She's had to work really hard to make that house happen. But one day, she receives an eviction notice. Now that's strange, because I bought this house. You're not really, how are you getting an eviction notice for your own house? So as it turns out, the real estate agent that she used and several of her friends and family ended up using had a falsified real estate license. And what he would do is he would go to those in the Memphis community that did not seem to have it all together, mostly the immigrant population that couldn't really understand the legal process of buying a house and would sell them false deeds to the houses. So what happens? Big corporation finds out about this guy. What do they see? There's a bunch of cheap houses on the market. So they go, find the houses that he sold, buy up all these houses, send her an eviction notice. So she goes to court, you know, and she's just trying to defend her house. She has two little girls. One of them's not so little. She's 15. But, you know, in our hearts, two little girls. Been there for so long. Judge says, I mean, I understand the situation. I know it sucks. But there's nothing legally that I can do because they own the house. If the corporation wants to, like, let you live there, obviously. But they don't because they want the house for themselves so they can sell it for much higher. So she has 60 days to leave. So I remember as we're dealing with her, you know, trying to help her out, trying to be the church family that she needs. The church that we go to, has a lot of capital, a lot of resources. We have former judges there. We have lawyers. We have important people at our church. And we thought that surely we would be able to move things around to help her, right? Because we have the people, the community-powered, empowered people that should be able to fix this situation, and we couldn't. And as we're struggling with her, I remember her crying and asking, why? Why us? This isn't fair. I played by the rules. I did what I was supposed to do. I did everything right. I played by the rules, and here I am, still cheated. I followed the rules. Why us? Why now? I have little kids to take care of. I can't be dealing with all this. We have to find a whole new home. All those tens of thousands of dollars just down the drain. And sometimes life does that to us, right? Sometimes life comes and attacks us, and they just leave us with gashes all over our body. Sometimes it's little nicks, but sometimes it's just gashes that seem mortal. Life comes and they just cut us, and it seems like it's going to be a mortal wound. It's going to be the end. What can be done? The terror attacks of the enemy sometimes just seem to be too much. So we're going to come back to this story. First, I want to read the Bible a little bit, if that's all right. So when Guilherme invited me, and I was thinking, well, when people invite me to come and speak at their church, one of the things I like to do, I'm going to preach on one of my favorite passages. You know, I want to preach about something that I'm passionate about. And, you know, the post-resurrection stories always fascinated me from when I was a little kid. As a little kid, they fascinated me because they didn't make any sense. I don't know about y'all, but when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, and I would read the post-resurrection stories, it's like, what's going on? It seems so weird, anticlimactic. I mean, Jesus rose from the dead. Shouldn't things look a little bit different? And then understand, and now there's some of my favorite stories. John chapter 20 is one of my favorite chapters in the whole Bible. So we're going to be reading a little bit from there. So in John chapter 20, Jesus rose from the dead. He's already appeared to Mary. And on the evening of that day, of the first day of the week, of Sunday, on the evening of that day, the first day of the week, the doors being locked where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said to them, "Peace be with you." When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord Jesus. When they saw the Lord, Jesus said to them, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, even so I am sending you." What an incredible moment this must be for the disciples. Jesus has already raised from the dead. They've heard some reports that, you know, something happened to Jesus' body. Maybe they're not sure what. And what is their reaction? They're scared. Right? They're enclosed in this house, afraid of the Jews. Jesus has already raised from the dead, and they're scared, secluded, protecting themselves. Jesus appears to them. And how do they react? It makes sense, right? With joy. It's true. Jesus really did rise from the grave. He is alive. He's with us. Not only that, he's giving us a task. He's giving us a vocation. He's saying, as the Father sent me, so I am sending you. That's powerful. I mean, have you thought about all the way, you know, how God sent Jesus into the world? And in that same way, Jesus was sending his disciples. I mean, just the goosebumps that must have been going down their back as they're interacting with Jesus. They're probably, whenever I get goosebumps, I show my wife. I'm sure they were showing each other. Look at all the goosebumps I'm having from seeing our resurrected Lord. And he's here and he's given us a vocation. He's breathing his spirit onto us. But as we know, that's not the end of this story because somebody was missing. It wasn't all the disciples. Because Thomas wasn't there. So it's now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin. I didn't put the whole thing up there, so you might have to read, either just listen to me or read along in your Bible. So I'm starting in John 20, 24. Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails and place my finger into the mark of the nails and place my hand into his side, I will never believe." Thomas gets a bad rap, I think. You know, his nickname is Doubting Thomas. It's not too nice. I really empathize with Thomas. I would completely understand. If I was in Thomas's situation, I would say the same things or maybe something even worse. Because you're trying to tell me that somebody who was dead is now not dead. That doesn't make sense. I saw him die. Maybe from afar. Maybe I was hiding. But man, he looked awfully dead to me. He was in a tomb. And now you're saying that he was here and he appeared. Okay, that's cool. You saw him. He was talking to you. He showed you the nails. But did you touch him? I mean, you could have all just been imagining this. You know, it's a stressful situation. The experts say that in stressful situations, we can tend to hallucinate, imagine things. You know, if you didn't actually touch him and feel it, how can you know that it was actually him? He was there in the flesh and not just some ghost or spirit that's appearing, trying to make you feel better, trying to make you make sense of it all. So 8 days later, a whole week of all his best friends telling him, Jesus truly is alive, and him saying, will y'all quit it? No, he's not. But he stays with them. They're still his friends. He hangs out with them 8 days later. His disciples were inside again, 1 week anniversary, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here and see my hands. Put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe. And Thomas answered him, my Lord and my God. Jesus said to him, have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. So Jesus appears again, as we know. That's not the end of the story. Thomas finds out that Jesus really did rise from the dead, right? He is alive. And Jesus invites Thomas, take out your hand. Put it where you need to see it. Put it in the holes in my hands. Put your finger into my side and feel and know that I am raised from the dead. And so Thomas does. And he only has one way to respond, right? My Lord and my God. And it's an amazing scene. I love it. I could preach on this passage in many different angles. But sometimes I look at this painting. Sometimes I think about what's going on. And there's something that's interesting to me. Something really stands out to me. This is the post-resurrection body of Jesus. So what does that mean? What is the point I'm trying to make? This is the post-resurrection body of Jesus. We're all promised a resurrection body, right? 1 Corinthians 15, Paul is talking about, you know, we have these bodies, these mortal bodies, but what the future, our hope, is that the corruptible bodies which we have will put on incorruptibility. That our mortal bodies will put on immortality. That's the language he uses as he's trying to describe what our hope and what our future is. That our mortal bodies are going to put on immortality. Our corruptible bodies, that body looks corruptible to me. It's going to put on incorruptibility. Should have practiced that word a little more. And that's great. I love that passage. 1 Corinthians 15 is one of my favorite passages. It ends with a little song of saying, you know, death has been defeated. Death, where is your sting? It's a great passage. But sometimes I might think to myself, that's great, but what does that look like? What do you mean exactly that our corruptible bodies are going to put on incorruptibility? Because he says it, but we don't exactly know what it's going to look like, right? I was reading an article one time, this disabled woman, she also dealt with chronic pain. She was just kind of reflecting on her life in the church. And there's a lot of things that I could say, but I won't say too much about her. But at some point, she's just reflecting on our obsession with what the body should be. We all have this ideal of what the body should be. And when it's not that, we pray for things to be different. We hope for things to be different. So for her, as somebody who dealt with chronic pain, as somebody who was dealing with a disability, she would hear all the time from church members, especially when she was part of a larger church, that they were praying for her, and because things needed to be different for her. And one of the things that she was reflecting on is that Jesus seemed to accept the limits of our human bodies. Jesus didn't come, put on a human body, and complain about the limits that he now had. He was accept with the limitations of a human body. Why is it that we seem so unwilling to accept the limitations of our body? And then what she pointed out is what I want to talk about right now. She pointed out that there's actually only one example of what our resurrection body will look like. There's only one example, only one body that we can use to kind of activate our imagination of what our resurrection bodies are going to look like. And it's Jesus, right? He's the first fruits of the resurrection. He already has his resurrection body put on. His corruptible body was clothed in incorruptibility. His mortal body was clothed in immortality. And guess what? Apparently, it still carries his wounds. Now that's interesting. If I were in charge of what our resurrection bodies would look like, if I was in charge of what Jesus' resurrection body should look like, I would take away those nasty, disgusting scars. I would take away those wounds that just signify betrayal and defeat and abandonment, destruction, death. I would take away those wounds. They're ugly. I don't know if y'all have seen really nasty wounds. Even when they scar up, you know, they're usually not the perfect picture. The models that we see are not the ones that are covered in wounds and scars. We don't see a person up there with a hole so big in their side that you can invite somebody to put and place their finger inside. I definitely take away those nasty scars. So my question is, why didn't God? Because we know that he could have. When he was deciding what our resurrection bodies are going to look like, what it's going to look like when our mortal bodies are clothed with immortality, he could have easily taken away the scars. But he didn't. He left them on God because God is a God of transformation and redemption. And he transformed those scars on Jesus' body from marks of death to marks of life. Through the resurrection, his wounds became a fountain of life for others. The scars on his hands and his side were supposed to be the proof, right, that he was dead. But instead, they became the proof that he's alive. It's supposed to signify, right, and show that evil had won. Death had won. Abandonment had won. Violence and aggression had won. But because he resurrected, it actually showed all the opposite. That life is more powerful than abandonment, than aggression, than violence, than any of those things that we can imagine. God transforms scars. What's interesting, as I think about Elisa, she's one of my favorite people on earth. We've only lived in Memphis for 2 years. I've only known her for 2 years. She's one of my favorite people on earth. And part of it is because of what I'm about to tell you. So she had to evacuate her home, right? 60 days she was given to move her entire life, years worth of her life that she deserved. Had to find a different place, found a place to rent. You know, the church helped as much as we could. A short time after she moves, maybe like 2 weeks after she's finally found a new place, there's still boxes all over. One of the grandmas of the church, that's what I call her. She's the mother of the preacher, and she visited all the time from Mexico and then decided she's going to stay. You know, she wants to be by her grandchildren. She loves them. She's going to stay in the U.S., so she's working out all the visas and all that. But in the meantime, she had been living with her son and her grandchildren, but then it started to become too cramped. She needed to go off on her own, have her own little house. So she was a nanny. She was taking care of the baby of another couple at church. And they actually had like this tiny little house on their property. And somebody else had been living there, but then they moved out. So they're like, hey, you know, if you want to live here, more than welcome to. So she moves to this new house. You know, it's just this little room basically, has a kitchen and bedroom, table, all that. But it's pretty much empty. And the grandma of the church, you know, didn't bring anything with her from Mexico. She wasn't making a lot of money. So one of the ladies at the church, one of the women, was making sure that she had everything, right? So she was making the list and getting people to buy different things so that she could have just the basic necessities to make a house livable, right? Because, you know, you live there and you have a bed, but you need more than that. You need forks, knives, cooking utensils, all sorts of things, and she doesn't have the money to buy it. So she's taking care of this, and Elisa comes up to her. I just happened to be talking to the woman in charge, so I got to witness the conversation. And she comes up to her and says, "What can I buy? What can I get?" And what does the woman in charge, her name is Rosa, what does Rosa say? She says what any normal human being would say. "What the heck are you talking about? We know your story. You still have boxes. You're still reeling from the great injustice done to you. How could you just come up to me and say, 'What can I get?'" And she says, "Well, the church took care of me. I can at least get plates." She got plates for our church grandma. She didn't word it like this, but in her words, what did I see? What did I hear? "I know that the enemy came and left me with a deep wound. And there were moments I thought it was mortal. I thought it was the end. How could I ever recover from this? I don't know. And there were moments when I realized, okay, it's not going to be the end of me, but it's really ugly. And I'm tired of talking about it. And it has so much power over me. But now, I see that even this wound, God can transform to give life to others. So I know what it's like to move to a new place. I just did it. I know how important it is to just have the little things to make it feel like home. So many people provided that for me. I need to be a part of providing that for somebody else." That's what this story is all about. It's God transforming the scars and wounds of our lives to actually demonstrate that His redeeming power is way more than we could imagine. And it's way more imaginative than we could imagine as well. Some of you may have seen a photo like this before. It often goes out and becomes popular on social media. You know, it becomes popular in different moments. It's the ancient... I don't know how ancient. Japanese art of kintsugi. So basically what this is they have these jars, right? And that sometimes jars fall. What happens when jars fall? They break, right? As a rambunctious kid who had too much energy, I know a lot about that. And usually what do you do when a jar breaks? Well, you need to get a new jar, right? But in this ancient art of kintsugi, the jar doesn't get thrown away, but instead gold is used to repair the jar. And it's more beautiful than it was before. And I can promise you and I can assure you that when Thomas looked at Jesus' scars, they were the most beautiful thing that he had ever seen. That when Jesus saw the gash, when Thomas saw the gash in Jesus' side, it was the most beautiful gash he'd ever seen. And his eyes had never beheld something so powerful and amazing and beautiful. And that's what God does with us. The wounds that he has, he transforms them and overlays them in gold. And even though they should be the proof that the enemy is more powerful than we are, in the end, it becomes testimony that Jesus is alive. Another one of my favorite passages is at the end of Revelation, Revelation 21. At the very end, chapter 21, God is speaking now. It's not an angel, it's not a messenger, it's God himself. "He who was seated on the throne," and John hears him say, "Behold." He does not say "behold" very often in Revelation. God does not speak often in Revelation. Usually it's messengers. So when God speaks in Revelation, we need to pay attention to that verse. Because Revelation is a long book with very few parts where God's doing the speaking. And here he says, "Behold." So not only is he speaking, but he's saying, "Behold, now pay attention. Listen to this." And he's saying, "I am making all things new." So I'm studying at a Harding School of Theology. We have a professor there who one of his specialties is Revelation. And one of his favorite things to point out is that it does not say, I am making all new things. I am making all things new. God could have easily taken away Jesus' scars. When we break things, we just want a new thing to replace it. But God is way more relentless than we are. And He sees our brokenness. Sometimes it's because of things we do. Sometimes we are just so broken and wounded and weary because of what life throws at us. He sees it and He says, I'm making you new. I'm laying you, overlaying you with gold. And you are going to become more beautiful than you ever have been. So if you have scars from life, know that God is transforming them into testimony for His kingdom work. Just like our sister, Elisa. Somehow, the enemy meant to kick her all the way down. And that story has started to and will continue to actually bring life to so many. Isn't that beautiful? The enemy meant to just completely destroy that household. But God now made them stronger because of that story. Us as a church, we're stronger because of her story. And as we share that story, as she shows her wounds to those around her, more and more people have more and more life just siphoned into them because of the wound that she carries. So if you have wounds like that, know that God is transforming them into life-giving power, that they are not the ugly marks of defeat, but instead glorious signals of victory. If you feel like you have wounds that can't yet recount that story, maybe you feel like you're still Jesus in the grave, waiting for that moment. If that's the case, I invite you to look at Jesus' wounds, because that's what He does with Thomas. He doesn't say, Thomas, are you stupid? Thomas, I've been with you for 3 years. Surely you'd understand by now. Thomas, all your friends knew. Why couldn't you? He says, Thomas, take your hand. Just place it into my side. If you feel like your wounds can't sing the song of victory yet, just look at Jesus, and He invites you to look at His wounds. Because when we come to Him and we see His wounds, there's only one thing that we can do, and it's proclaim, my Lord and my God. So I'll finish with one last thing. It's a poem. It's called Jesus of the Scars. This I'll be done. It's by someone called Edward Shillito. It's written in 1919. The end of the Great War, World War I. He had seen so much bloodshed. He had seen more than his fair share of wounds. And he writes, if we have never sought, we seek thee now. Thine eyes burn through the dark, our only stars. We must have sight of thorn pricks on thy brow. We must have thee, O Jesus of the scars. The heavens frighten us, they are too calm. In all the universe, we have no place. Our wounds are hurting us. Where is the balm? Lord Jesus, by thy scars, we claim thy grace. If, when the doors are shut, thou drawest near, only reveal those hands, that side of thine. We know today what wounds are. Have no fear. Show us thy scars. We know the countersign. The other gods were strong, but thou wast weak. They rode, but thou didst stumble to a throne. But to our wounds, only God's wounds can speak, and not a God his wounds, but thou alone. God bless.